Hello there and welcome to Full Chat with me, David Prutton.
And me, Ewan Thomas, celebrating all things we love about being on two wheels. Full Chat is powered by Bikesure. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikesure will tailor a quote to your exact needs, helping you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance.
Don't forget to press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or you can press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
Now, I'm excited about this one because today's guest is a gent who quite simply is Mr. Bike Culture. He is the co-founder of Bike Shed Motorcycle Club in London. If you haven't been there, let me tell you, that place is like nothing else. He's an absolute gent, a beautiful man, and he loves two wheels. It is, of course, Dutch Van Someren. Have I said that right? So I only know you as Dutch. Have I said that right, Dutch?
No, that's perfect.
That's it.
That's why everyone calls me Dutch, because they don't want to have to struggle with a mouthful of my full name.
It's true though, isn't it, Prutz? I know we're going to get onto it, but we'll talk about the bike shed and obviously how you love bikes. But I know Prutz has been there, he's a big fan
of it. Amazing.
As well. I mean, there's nothing like it.
No.
I love it.
And I think that's a really good jump off point, because obviously there's one in Shoreditch, there's now one in LA, and it's not just the physical places, is it, Dutch? You've got the bike shed show as well. Just talk to us, if someone's coming to this and they've never heard of it, they don't know what is it as an entity, what is it as a brand, as a business, and where does it all come from?
Well, firstly, thanks for the wicked intro. Now I have to live up to it. But no, really kind of you both. I mean, effectively, Bike Shed is a place that's about motorcycles, but it's for everyone. We've had lots of sort of attempts to try and explain that to people. We've said things along the lines of, we're a motorcycle club, but you don't need to join the club and you don't have to ride a motorcycle, which confuses people a lot. Because, you know, we want everyone to come. It's got to be accessible. And we also say it's for the people who love motorcycles and the people who love people who love motorcycles. But really, it's a destination that celebrates motorcycle culture. My background is media and television, and I was in that industry for a long time. But I was always a motorcycle rider. Didn't necessarily consider myself as a biker. And that's interesting because I spent all my time and all my money on motorcycles. And I thought there was a bit of a gap in the market for places that were a bit more broad and a bit more open and celebrated bike culture and that weren't hardcore, because you spend all your life as a motorcycle rider trying to ascend to the lofty heights of people that have got their knee down at the Nürburgring and, you know the precise miles per gallon of their latest large capacity motorcycle. And what we're doing is we're blocking new people, and we're also making it unfriendly for people who are not aficionados. We're constant bullshit detectors, and we push people away. And I wanted to create a place that was really open and didn't mind people that just say, I like that bike, it looks nice, what color do you call that? And also a place where actually it wasn't spit and sawdust, because I felt like bike culture was stuck in the 70s. We're always trying to live up to some sort of Sons of Anarchy idea. Or sports bike riding with unrealistic ideas about how good you should be on a bike. But, you know, the 99%ers aren't any of those people. You know, they're not MotoGP riders, and they're not in some MC about to axe you to death. So I thought it would be quite nice to have a destination that was built around the culture that everybody else likes, which is a modern world where you get good service and good food and everyone's nice to each other.
I love it. It's not just about good food. It's that community feel. Whenever I've been there, you know, you can get good clothing. You can get your beard trimmed. You can get your hair cut. You know, you can see like-minded people and everyone's welcome. Like you said, you don't have to be a biking pro. You don't even have to be a biker. But I guarantee when you leave the place, you'll want to be a biker or you'll be in love with bikes. You get to see some amazing machinery as well. Now, without blowing too much smoke up your backside, I think you've broken the mold with it. I mean, what? I can't recall anything really like it before. I mean, sure, and you're in a part of town which is hipster, it's cool. What was there anything like the bike shed before? Because I can't recall it.
I mean, not really. I was a little bit inspired by what I thought or hoped Deus was going to be. And because Deus is an amazing brand, they've been around a long time. They've got some amazing design. And I love the you know what they were doing at the time when we first started, because it was this kind of temple of enthusiasm for motorcycle culture. And they created really good gear and apparel, and they had some nice destinations. But what I didn't feel when I went to those places was community. It was like, well, where is everyone? You know, where are the people that you hang out with, and why has nobody asked me about my bike I've just ridden in on? Because as riders, what we really want when we turn up somewhere is for people to go, oh, that's nice. What have you done? Where'd you get those pipes? You know, we want people to notice. We want someone to, you know, give a monkeys that we've turned up. And whilst I thought Deus had all the gear, I thought what they didn't have was all the culture. So I was a bit inspired by that. And I guess also I was quite an early member of Soho House when Soho House was really about media people. You know, I was a TV director and there was one Soho House and it was like a TV club, really. It wasn't what it is now. Of kind of celebrities and kind of whatever you want to describe it as. It was a place where if you worked in broadcasting and worked in Soho, as I did, and lived in Soho, I lived there too. It was just our club where we all went and we hung out on, you know, broken old Chesterfield sofas, actually, because when it was new, it was like that. And so I kind of thought, well, there's this culture piece where you can kind of hang out in a club-like vibe. But also I felt like when you meet another biker, it's like being in a secret club.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you could go to you could get invited to a boring wedding where you don't really know everyone that well. And then you find that on your tables are someone who rides a bike and suddenly you're best buddies for the whole of the time you're there because it's like this secret handshake. Mm. But there wasn't really anything before. I mean, there was this thing happening in about 2011, 2012 when we started. The Distinguished Gentleman's Ride started about the same time with Mark Howard in Sydney. And we were long distance online friends. So when he did the first DGR in Sydney, we did the first DGR in London.
Such and a great so cause that was as well, thing. That one, Dutch, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. And still going strong. Yeah. And it's still an amazing cultural phenomenon, I think. And also really spoke for me about the positive side of bikers, you know, gentlemen bikers in tweed with handlebar mustaches riding, you know, vintage and classic bikes. Awesome. It's the opposite of Sons of Anarchy. I love that. So there was the DGR and there were a few small destinations and, you know, there were shops around and there were brands around building custom bikes. But there was nothing that did what we were doing, which was why we did it.
That sense of growth as well. I mean, the wonderful thing about, I mean, the venue in Shoreditch, Dutch, is just, it's magnificent. And you talk about coming in and bikers talking about bikes. That first time because I'd been there before without being on my bike. And obviously you sit outside when the weather's nice and you see people coming in on the bikes. And then you think, all right, next time I'm down there, I'll try and get over on my bike. So you get over on your bike, you pull in, and you talk about getting your knee down. You come wobbling in there thinking, oh God, don't go too fast. Don't
stack it.
Don't drop it and don't stall it. So you're trying to come in between all the tables and chairs, trying to be dead cool because everyone's looking over. And it is, like you say, it's bikers, it's non-bikers, it's people across a broad spectrum, people there on a Saturday morning for a bit of brunch because the food's fantastic. And you come wobbling in thinking, no, it'll be all right. And you get parked up and you mop your brow and think, brilliant, I'm in. That was my first kind of port of call of getting into the Shoreditch one. And I've got a very close friend of mine that I grew up with who lives over in LA and he's been keeping a keen eye on what you've done in LA. So Shoreditch, glorious. What you've done in Los Angeles looks absolutely staggering. The size of it, what that venue can do, the people that have been there. I was watching a few of the bits online with Hugh McGregor there and Charlie Borman there. That to me looks like Shoreditch on steroids. Is the one coming after that somewhere else? How far does this branch out? How far does it reach?
Well, I mean, the next plan is Dubai.
Wow.
And it's driven by world economics, really. I mean, you know, I didn't really start Bike Shed to be a restaurant, and I'm not a restaurateur. But obviously, if you want people to turn up every day, you better feed them, and you have to do a really good job of that. And then obviously, there's the retail and the events and the experience and the communities actually are core. But you know, it's quite difficult to make money out of running a restaurant these days. I mean, I don't if you guys follow any of that kind of news, you know, it's a terrible business to be in right now because of sort of tax and minimum wage and all the other things and you know, we live in a culture right now where, you know, the government needs to take more and more money away to fund things that it probably, you know, is kind of overspent on. So it's a terrible business to be in. So we need to go where there's enough scale to actually operate that kind of business. And, you know, we bit off a big chunk when we went to Dubai, when we went to LA. And what it did do was it got people interested in what we were doing globally and said, where else can we do this? And we met a group of people in Dubai who said, we really want to open Bike Shed in Dubai. So after getting to know them for a year and trusting them to not mess it up and do a good job and capture our spirit and our sort of, you know, our mission, you know, that's the next one that's going to happen. But partly based on the fact that, you know, that's where there's revenue to be made for the people that will be the operators. But what it also did was it spun us off into creating a franchise model for our business. Because what we don't have the money to do is just start popping bike shop bike sheds up all over the world. I would love that. That would be great if we were funded like a Soho House type company or whoever. That would be great to just go, oh, we'll go and open one up over there. Because the problem is they have to be good and they have to be big.
Yeah.
You can't do tiny ones because people have an expectation. And so now what we're doing is we're talking to a lot of potential operators who would take on bike sheds where they live. And all of them are bikers, including the guys in Dubai. And they're enthusiasts and they're people that have been to Bike Shed on multiple occasions. And they want to be able to do it there. And in a way, what we're doing is we're giving the brand to the community, to those people that we trust. A lot of, you know, some of them are members who've moved out of London, who've said, well, can I open Bike Shed where I live in Australia? And we're like, well, yeah, that would be great. Or Austin in Texas. So the growth going forward is actually kind of in other people's hands. Mm-hmm. So it's really about people coming to us and saying, you know, I live in XYZ and I want to open a bike shed here and I think there's a market. And, you know, we've got the backing and we've got the right partners and we've got operating experience or we've got operators that we can work with. And then there's a process of us putting that together. So I'd like to think in the next couple of years, we might open quite a few. And we're having five or six conversations in parallel with various people. But the first one signed is Dubai and it will be huge and it'll be bigger than LA.
Wow.
And it'll be all singing, all dancing because that's how they do things in Dubai.
I just love, you're clearly a very smart man. We know that, but I just love your vision and your enthusiasm. I mean, you're not talking about, with all due respect, knocking one up in Blackpool or something. You know, you've got LA, you're now saying Dubai. I'm assuming somewhere like Paris would be next or whatever, but it just sounds like your vision is brilliant. You're always looking forward. But can I ask your wife, Vicky, she's heavily involved, but did she ever question it when you first came up with this idea? Was she thinking, oh, you're crazy? Was she into bikes as well? So it was an easy sell. Because for me, I'm always saying to Prats, if I buy a new toy, I'm literally hiding it from my missus. We're not talking about a global franchise. You know, what you do is huge. I'm assuming Vicky's behind it all the way.
Yeah, I mean, it was actually the other way around. I mean, we started this, you know, she was right beside me when this was first an idea. And we worked on, I mean, you know, we both work in business. She was, you know, commercially senior at Virgin Media when we met and got together. So she was, you know, responsible for earning money for them. And we worked at HarperCollins Publishers together as well, where she sort of ran the commercial creative teams. And, you know, she's a very good business strategist and a very tough negotiator as well and very good at contracts. And, you know, her role in the business was really to not only push me forward, but to jump in with both feet right at the beginning and lend her expertise to it. And she does ride. When we very first got together, she was an off-road rider and learned to ride across fields in Kent. And but she very quickly got into riding alongside me. She didn't want to be pillion on the back. She's a fast rider too. When she wants to be, she can be very quick. And she doesn't like people passing her, so good luck on the track day. But she was always right in. And I think what she did was she was always able to elevate the commercial part of things because I had a very big vision creatively as an ex-creative director in broadcasting. My whole thing was brand and communications and people and how to bring people together under sort of a banner. And she was like, well, this is how we monetize this and this is how we get brands involved. And she was pivotal into making sure that we worked with the big brands like Triumph and Harley Davidson and Yamaha and, you know, Polaris and Royal Enfield and all the brands that have come in and supported us. And we've worked with pretty much everyone in the industry at sponsorship level, especially in our shows. And also she had a fantastic events background. So when we did the first Bike Shed show, she was the one that really had that eye for detail. And also in how we kit out the venues and what they look like. She doesn't compromise.
It sounds like it's a match made in heaven. I mean, you've got the perfect woman there. She's behind you all the way. She's more than just alongside you. She's pushing it forward and ahead and rides a bike very fast. I mean, you've completed it.
Yeah, no, it's been brilliant. And it's been a fantastic journey. I mean, we're about to celebrate our 10th anniversary in London, which is amazing, actually, this November. And it's crazy to think 10 years ago that we, you know, took the crazy risks that we did. You know, we got a lease for Arches in Shoreditch with no alcohol license and no experience in operating a bar or a restaurant or a shop. We knew how to run events and a brand, but, you know, it was a big leap of faith. And, you know, doing it as a couple was the thing that made it possible.
You mentioned the Bike Shed show there, Dutch, and it's another one that I've been to, which has been to it on a bike and just as a normal kind of passer through. that's grown exponentially as well, isn't it? And the journey that comes from you thinking about moving something for the weekend, bike shed wise, with regards to curating the bikes that come to that type of place, the pop-ups, the brands, as you say, the big brands we're talking about across the board, and catering for all and sundry, because that element of it being the bike shed in Shoreditch and what it could mean to certain people and think, well, it's not really for me. And you go there and you open your doors to absolutely everyone. The bikes there are across the whole spectrum, from 125s, electric, all the way up to sports bikes, the cruisers, the custom scene. That's something that, again, is another huge feather in your cap, pulling that type of thing together, because that is unlike any other bike show that you and I have been to several. I'm sure you've been to hundreds in your time. That is specifically and uniquely the bike shed, isn't it? You must be very proud of that and how it's grown.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, the bike shed, the show, the moto show is really our real DNA, because we wanted to create a celebration of the people and the culture that we loved around biking. And, you know, we love that sort of idea that that on the one hand, it's this level playing field that makes everyone kind of the same, but also loads of other people like bikes who don't ride. And we thought there should be a show that those people could enjoy, where you can bring your friends and your family and your kids and all the rest of it. And in a way, the destination that came of it is actually the show never closing its doors. It's us always being there. But the show was really the real thing that we sort of centered ourselves on. And we wanted it to be, we centered it around the idea of custom culture, because that's where you get the best creativity and the best engineering and the best eye candy. But it really is about all kinds of bikes. And it really is about all, you know, all the genres as well. It's about adventure bikes and sports bikes and street bikes and, you know, choppers and cruisers. It's all of it. And in some ways, it's the purest form of what we are. And you know, and the idea was to do a bike show that was about bikes, not about the industry, and also to do a show where the food was good and the hospitality was good and it was easy to get to on public transport and you didn't have to ride a bike to get there in a big city venue. I mean, it's an incredibly difficult show to put on. It's really expensive.
Yeah. Logistically as well, I presume, given where it is.
It's bonkers because mostly bike shows are in a giant warehouse in the middle of nowhere.
Next to a motorway that you can get in an hour.
Yeah, that's how you do a bike show, because they're cost effective to hire and they're huge and they're cheap and it's easy to load in and load out. And, you know, you're not, you know, or in a big field. You can do amazing bike shows if you just got big fields and you know, that's fantastic. But we wanted to do something that was quite premium, but we also wanted to do something that wasn't a premium price to attend. And that's really difficult to do because we always want everything to be affordable. You know, we don't ever want Bike Shed to be the posh boys bike club. We always wanted to be for everyone and affordable. And actually, that's one of our biggest challenges, is how do we do something really good and really nice and aspirational without being posh and expensive? And the show that, you know, that's the challenge doing it at Tobacco Dock, is that it's an expensive show to put on, but it really sums up the best of us and the best of the industry and the best people. And it's a celebration. And it's going to, I think we did our 13th show last year. So next year is going to be our 14th show in that May bank holiday, which is bonkers.
The bit that you put on your socials as well, because I'd seen it somewhere else on Instagram, which when you go to the bike shed show, and if anyone's listening that hasn't been, please get yourself there, because it's the good thing is as well, more often than not, the weather's nice. You know what I mean? You're not huddled inside a tin can where it's chucking it down outside. You can ride your bike there and get involved. And you go there and you look at these beautiful works of art, these bespoke motorcycles. And the bit that you put on your socials about, I think it was over in America, someone sitting on one of the models and you're going, why are you going anywhere near that bike? And it collapses and everyone runs over to try and help them out. The big thing is, if you go to the bike shed show and there's a work of art, don't sit on it, basically.
Yeah, I never understood why anyone would do that. But on the other hand, when you go to bike shows normally, you know, the bikes are behind ropes.
Yeah.
Or they're not accessible, unless it's a trade fair where they want you to sit on them, in which case they're kind of nailed to the floor. But what we wanted to do was take away the ropes, because we're like, well, our customers are grown-ups. So they're not going to sit
them
on your bike.
Yeah.
I mean, that bit of footage was from the One Moto Show in the US. And basically, No, it's not the One Moto Show. It's from Moto Beach, Roland Sands event. It's a brilliant event. But the thing is, it's also open to what somebody called the other day, muggles, people that don't really know about bikes at all. And, you know, it's on the beach. Anyone can go, which meant probably a whole bunch of people just went there and go, oh, we'll sit on that bike and take a picture for our Instagram. And it was California after all. So that's why That's never happened at a bike shed show in 13 years or in our venue that's been open for 10. It doesn't happen in LA, in our LA venue either. But yeah, it happened at Moto Beach.
Yeah, I've been to car shows and people are letting their kids like literally sit on the bonnet of cars as well. And you're thinking, that's someone's pride and joy. And motorbikes are exactly the same. It's so personal. But what I love is everyone's inclusive with biking. And we talk to many great people like yourselves who come on here and they just love the fact that when you're on a bike, you've got that common bond, you've got that camaraderie and you've got something special. But where did your journey start? Because obviously we know about the bike show and how well it's going, but where did your love of two wheels start out? Was it from a father or an uncle, or was it just a way of commuting? Where did it start?
Actually, saying the word uncle, you reminded me. My uncle Tony had a GPZ 900R and he was a super cool dude. Like really cool dude. He's still alive. He's awesome. Lives in Canada. Amazing guy. 80 something, and a bit of a proper dude. And his GPZ 900, and then obviously seeing that in Top Gun. And I had one in the end. But yeah, so he was a little bit of an inspiration. But I was a Sussex boy, and you know, when I was 17, if you wanted to go to the pub or see your girlfriend, and you lived in Sussex, you needed a motorbike. It's that simple. I mean, I wasn't buying a car at that age in the whatever it was, 70s. And, you know, you didn't do that. So you got your bike license as soon as you could and got yourself a motorcycle. And I got a TS125X, which looked like an RM motocross bike. Mm-hmm. Thought it was the coolest thing in the world and ripped it round fields and roads in Sussex. Occasionally rode into Fleet and rode on military tank testing grounds and got chased by the military police and did stupid stuff. You know, tried to learn to wheelie somehow, never fell off a bike wheeling it. I don't know how. And mostly learned off-road in quarries and things like that. But for me, the bike was freedom. It was transport. Mm. But very quickly, it starts to define who you are because it dictates the shoes on your feet and what you're wearing. It's how you arrive at a pub. You're in a leather jacket and you're wearing boots and you've got a crash helmet. And so it very quickly becomes a little bit of you. And then when I finally moved to London, there was no question of me not having a motorbike. I actually came to London and I had a KTM 640 LC red, white and blue with battery lights on a Q plate. And that was my transport. It didn't have a side stand. I had to lean it against the wall. And that was my first bike in London when I moved to London, which is ridiculous now when you look at it. It was so loud and so ridiculous. And I remember being stopped by a copper on Waterloo Bridge and he just wanted to look at it. He was like, nice bike. And I thought I was in big trouble. And he just went, that's a bit fruity for London, isn't it? And I was like, yeah. But, you know, so for me, it was just transport. And I had lots and lots of sort of, I guess, what we call trail bikes in those days. And now people call them dual sport. But I was really into sort of, I'm a crap off-road rider. I love doing it. I'm really bad at it, but I really enjoy it. And I've always been into sort of that dirt bikey scrambler vibe. And that was my thing until I loved the look of cafe racers and discovered that I quite like track days. But yeah, it was transport. It was transport with glamour that made the girls think you were cool. And you could do a wheelie past the school gates.
Do you know what, Prats? I think that's a really good point, right? It's cool. You think of any photo shoot with a guy stood in front of a nice car looking cooler than someone looking standing in front of a bike. Bikes always look cooler. They just do. And like you said, I can imagine you. Like I was smiling when you said, you know, going to the pub, going to see a girlfriend. Mm. I was exactly the same. I didn't even care about passing my car test. As soon as I had that TZR125 with a YPVS system, I was like, yeah, I'm happy. I've got independence. I look cool. And I loved it. There was something so special. And that's why the three of us are here chatting. It's hard to explain to people who don't like bikes, but there is something so magical about biking. It really is.
The key that's the lock in the door, obviously, is passing your test, isn't it? And we've spoken to so many people, Dutch, over the course of doing so many great episodes of this that we really, really love doing. But can you remember that time when you went round and then you pull in and then they either say, well done, or they say, come back?
Oh, yeah. My test, I think I did it in 1983 or something, or whenever it was. I can't even remember. My God, I'm so bad at decades, never mind dates. But I think he said, ride up the road, turn right again, and then you'll come to a junction, turn right, and then you'll see me like a surprise. Like, you'll see me. As if that's magical. Like, how did you appear? Like, I've just ridden in a square. And he said, when I tap my clipboard, you need to do an emergency stop. And I went round, saw him again, obviously, because I'd gone round a square, did an emergency stop. And then I pulled in and he said, congratulations, you passed your test.
That was the test. That was no intercom system, nothing.
No comms, I'm old.
Yeah, well, I'm old. I did it in 1991, but we had some really, I couldn't hear him, dodgy intercom, and I actually skidded on my emergency stop on some leaves, and I was devastated. He failed me first time, and he said, don't worry, you'll be back soon. And it was lovely, and I came back, same instructor, same tester, and I passed straight away. But that's rambling, that's easy back in your day.
It was ridiculous. So, yeah, I do remember. I mean, obviously, it was very satisfying to pass. And I wasn't that bothered about my car test. I mean, I got it. I've only owned a few cars. I've owned about four cars, you know, in my many years. I've probably had about 30 motorcycles. I've got five now, I think. So, yeah, I've always, that's my primary transport. It's how I get around.
And if you mentioned moving to London and that period of time that you've been in London and riding bikes in around, living in Soho and getting around the city. Have you seen a change in that? Because I've always felt, because I'm way up in North Yorkshire, but coming down to London, you almost, by the time you get here, you sort out the M25 or whichever, or coming in on the M4, which I normally do. And then if you do go into town, I've found whether it's by design or whether it's just by default, that you have to have your head in a London mode of riding. Because suddenly, that gap that you wouldn't really go anywhere near up north, you're like, well, if he's doing it on that with a delivery on the back, I'm following him. Come on, we're off. And it becomes, it's such a thrill to do it. Is it ever exhausting? Has it changed in that kind of lifespan so far of your riding career in the capital?
And the capital's changed immeasurably, mostly because they've made it incredibly difficult to ride anywhere because they've shrunk the lanes. You know, they've created this giant cycle superhighway, which is a lovely idea if you lived in Amsterdam, which I did. And it's great in Amsterdam, but we don't live in Amsterdam. We live in this giant city that's got hills and it's really big. And, you know, it's nice if you live in Battersea and you work in the West End, but it's not really much good for anybody else. And so they've squeezed the roads and the lanes have become dangerously narrow for filtering.
Yeah.
In some parts of London, some boroughs, you can use bus lanes and some you can't. And it's not really clear which. And also bus lanes are quite dangerous because they leave a gap where people quite often do right turns and cut across your path. It's changed immeasurably in the physical structural layout and all the 20 mile an hour speed limits. I mean, my personal opinion is they're dangerous because people speed up between the speed cameras to make up for lost time. I think it makes people more likely to run a red light to try and catch time. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm sure accidents are down and if you do get hit, you won't die. But I don't think it's a good thing, especially coming down the Holloway Road, three lanes of road with, you know, hardly any junctions, and then you have to do 20 miles an hour. So it's changed completely. Mm-hmm. But actually, the mindset's exactly the same. You get around, everybody on the road. Actually, London drivers are good drivers. Mm. They're used to chaos. They really are good at observational skills. They're good at using their indicators.
And they're quite like bikes as well, though. That's what I found in bikers. If there's a gap, it's like, go on, you get going if you want to get ahead of me. Yeah.
Oh yeah, they're almost apologetic if they're blocking you. Yeah. You'll see them turn their wheels and try and move out the way to let you to the front of the queue. But basically, if there's a hole, you fill it. That's the rule. Yeah. The rule is, you leave me a gap, mate. I'm going in there. If my handlebars will fit, then here I come. And if you're not paying attention, I might blip my throttle as I go past to say, hello, excuse me, I'm just coming through. But generally speaking, I mean, I commute to work every day and I enjoy it. Mm. I actually enjoy the commute. It's only a few miles. And you learn the flow and you learn where the phasing of the lights and what speed to be at to get there just as it turns green. And it's almost like a points game. Like, can you do the whole journey without putting your feet down?
Yeah.
I really like it. Honestly, I enjoy it. But it's always been that. Mm. They've just put more obstacles in the way. Maybe it's like leveling up over the last two, 3 decades. Yeah. They've just made it harder and now I'm on level 5. But at the end of the day, the rules of the road are the same. Mm. If you see a gap, fill it. Get to the front and don't muck around. Mm. And if you see a yellow box high up, go 20 miles an hour.
I tell you what, I think Dutch, you've probably answered this next question, especially as you articulated so well. Your love of cars, you've had about four, you've had 30 bikes, you've still got five. We'll get onto that. But in a nutshell, what is it about biking that still does it for you? You know, it just gets you. What's so magical about it?
It's the physicality of riding, I think. I mean, it's like juggling, isn't it? You're there doing something really complex. And if you talk to people that fly planes and helicopters, I mean, I know a few helicopter pilots actually, and I was talking to one of them recently. He said, you know, it's harder to ride a bike than fly a helicopter. You know, he said, that's actually way more of a joke. Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, he was explaining how it works and you're sort of juggling these forces and you've got the, I can't remember what they call the cyclic or whatever, and you're controlling the rudder with your feet that stops it going that way. And he said, it's just the same as balancing motorcycles. And, you know, pulling away on a hill start and then turning left. All of those things are really complicated to do and very, very difficult. And I think there's something about the human body, you know, and you're a sportsman, you know, you understand when the human body is operating holistically, where you're using mind and body and your brain to do really complicated things, that's when the human body is at its best. And I think when we get all the endorphins and we really feel who we are, and motorcycling is a really great expression of that. And, you know, you're leaning around corners and you're balancing the clutch and the throw. It's why I don't like electric bikes, because there's not an art to it. You know, I like the fact it's difficult to ride a bike and, you know, using the gears to slow you down, using engine braking or choosing what gear to be in for maximum acceleration. You've got this constant juggle. And, you know, I remember a few years ago when somebody used the word mindfulness, and I was like, well, what's mindfulness? And they were like, well, being in the moment, being in the right now. And I was like, oh, right, it's right, riding a motorbike. You can't really, you know, I do sometimes drift off when I'm riding on a proper journey, but mostly you're really focused on the road. You're feeling the road surface under your tires, how much grip there is, you know, and you're really aware of everything around you because somebody might try and take you out. You're avoiding speed cameras and doing something silly in front of the officer of the law. And you're constantly paying attention to bicycles and pedestrians and chaos. And I think that does something to the human soul. And then you look really cool doing it. And you're on a machine which is exciting and beautifully designed. You know, the kind of the two wheels and an engine with a seat and a tank and a pair of handlebars. They're beautiful things to look at. They're design icons. And you're doing something other people can't do, that other people want to do. So all of those things add up to something brilliant. And that's why, you know, and you touched on it earlier, that's why motorcycles are in music and advertising and movies. And, you know, if you want to be cool in a music video, you're on a bike. If you want to sell Chanel No. 5, you get Keira Knightley to ride a Ducati 750 SS and look sexy in a one piece. It's that. It's James Bond's on a motorcycle. Mm. Jason Bourne's on a motorcycle. Yeah. You know, Tom Hardy has to ride a motorcycle and be in a bike film. Every, you know, Batman's on a motorcycle. Who isn't on a motorcycle that's trying to be cool? And if you're the badass dude, if you're the inappropriate boyfriend in a rom-com, you arrive on a motorcycle.
It's true. It's so true.
Other people love bikes. Other people celebrate bike culture as being standout, different, cool, alternative. It's in advertising. It's in marketing. It's in pop videos. And I think we forget to embrace that, actually. We always think that's kind of, again, muggles who don't know what they're talking about. But actually, it's really cool, and we get to be part of it. And I think one of the reasons people like coming to the bike shed, half our customers aren't riders. They're there for the eye candy. I've seen some cool dudes ride in an inappropriate open-face helmet on a sort of vintage Triumph that, you know, pops and splatters as it go past and probably won't start when they leave. But they're there for the eye candy because it's cool. It's Steve McQueen. Mm. You know, it's that.
It's amazing the way you describe it, Dutch. And when Ewan said in the intro about being Mr. Bike, I mean, that is exactly it. The advertising that you've reeled off there with regards to who and what and where and the people that we're talking about is, it's funny how it all, we know it and we feel it in our bones, but the minute you start articulating it, it really does all stack up, doesn't it? We're just gonna have a quick bit of mid-show housekeeping here. If you haven't already, please press subscribe on YouTube so that you never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from. And it's great what you said about you've got friends at helicopter pilots. I suppose the big difference is as well, there's also not 100 other helicopter pilots at the same time all trying for the same bit of airspace. So yes, motorcycling is a lot more complicated than people make out. But speaking of motorcycles, you mentioned you've currently got 5 in the shed. Apologies for the pun there, but what is it? I mean, I've seen some of the custom stuff that you've put on YouTube or on your socials. What's currently in the stable and what's your favorite, if you've got one?
It's hard to have favorites. It's like favorite children, isn't it? Although both my daughters do have t-shirts that say favorite daughter, but I bought two. I'm not an idiot. But I think I've fallen in love with the Triumph 1200 engine. I've got a Thruxton 1200 RS, and I've got one in London and I've got one in LA because they're such good bikes. I didn't know what else I wanted to ride for the bike that can kind of do it all, because you can take it around a track or you can trundle to work or you can ride to Biarritz and they all work. It's such a brilliant bike, and the engine is the kind of engine that makes you a much better rider than you deserve to be, because you can be in the wrong gear and you can get it all wrong and the bike will save you. So it's a brilliant bike, and Triumph made a huge effort to make their bikes really work. And they're beautiful things. So I'm a bit of a Triumph person. So I've got these two Thruxtons. I've got a black one in LA and a white one in London, so I'm an idiot. But the one in LA is cafe racer style with the fairing and low clip-ons. And the one in London, I've actually put handlebars on. So I've turned it into a speed twin, mm-hmm. which is hilarious. But that's what I've done. I've also got a Desert X, the Ducati.
Very nice.
Which is such a good bike. I mean, I had a Tenere 750 back in the day with the twin spotlights on the fairing. And I love that bike. And the Desert X reminds me of the old, you know, Kajiva Elephant, the Dakar winning, well, Dakar racing bike. Such a cool thing. My legs are way too short for it. I barely touch the ground. I've opted for the rally seat, which means it's even taller. So I'm an idiot, but I didn't want to ruin the suspension. So you'll see me wobbling at the lights, having to put one foot down and slide my sort of bum cheeks off the seat. So that's a brilliant bike and I love it. I wish it was like 10% smaller though. And I've got a Royal Enfield custom bike here in the bike shed in the shop, which I love, is brilliant, but I don't ride it because it's such a show bike and it looks really nice and it sits in the shop and it's a bit iconic. So at the moment we're working on another one. But before I talk about that, I've also got a Ducati, the Paul Smart limited edition, 1000cc 2006, which is a beautiful thing.
Very nice.
And a couple of my bikes are sort of now Vicky's bikes. So I've also got another one of those kind of sport classics. Mm-hmm. But at the moment, I'm also working on a project on the Royal Enfield Bear, which I won't give too much away about. But as you know, I like scramblers and the Bear is a scrambler.
Yeah, very so cool looking bike, yeah.
650 twin. And we're sort of turning it into the bike that we think the original designers would have wanted it to be if they didn't have budgetary restrictions, let's just say. Which is all, I think the best custom work is actually taking a bike that a manufacturer has made where they've had to struggle through regulations, budgets, restrictions, all the rules that they have to follow. You know, they've been told they've got to build a bike that's the same price as the competition. And you know they're limited. And I think what you do when you customize a bike is to take away those limits and go, well, what would this bike have been if you didn't have all those limitations? You know, how good can it be? Mm.
I love the fact that all of your bikes you described, not only I can see the joy in your face, but they've all been customized. It was all like, I've done a bit of this, I put handlebars on that one, I've changed this. And I think that's the beauty of biking. You can personalize it to your own desires, can't you? But one thing I wanted to know, I mean, I'm sure you get lots of celebs coming to the bike shed. We talked to some great guests on here and they all say the same thing. There's something very unique and special about when you're on that bike and the visor comes down, you're not a Hollywood star anymore. You're just another guy on a bike or another girl on a bike. Do you feel that when you ride as well, that not only can you switch off, but is there anything that can compare in your opinion to visor down, no one knows who I am, I can do what I want? You don't get that freedom anywhere else apart from being on a bike, I don't think.
No, I can't imagine it, actually. I can't think what else really quite does all of those things. There are lots of things that do some of those things, but not all of them all at once. And I think that's the thing about biking is it's so many things all at once because it's also an analog escape in a digital world. It's real friends instead of friends on Facebook or Instagram. It's like so many things you can't, a real adventure. You're not just watching a video, you're doing it. There's so many things, so many boxes it ticks. But I think the thing I do love about it is what you said is it levels the playing field because when a celebrity comes to Bike Shed, they're just a biker. It's like, well, what did you ride in on? You know, I remember, who's that? Thomas Sangster, whatever his name is, Branston Pickle. I can't remember his name. The guy who was in About a Boy.
Oh, right. Yeah.
He's a lovely guy, and it's really bad. I'm terrible with names, especially celebrity ones in films. But he came in on this, he had a Ducati Monster, and I think it was the 800 with the single side trellis swing arm. And he was there with a mate, and somebody started walking towards him. And I think he was like, oh, no, someone's going to ask me for my autograph. And they went, oh, is that the 800? Oh, I love that bike. I love the trellis swing. I just wanted to talk to him about bikes. And it was like, is that carbs or fuel injection? And he loved the fact that someone just wanted to talk to him about his bike because you turn up and you're just another biker. Mm. And so it doesn't matter who you are. You know, we've got fantastic sort of partners and backers and, you know, Charlie Borman, Ewan McGregor's come on board recently as one of our backers, as one of our investors. And we've got Woody Harrelson and Tom Hardy and a whole bunch of cool people, you know, badass Pom Clementif, who you've probably seen in the Mission Impossible stuff. Mm-hmm. And they came on board and they're bikers. They come and they ride. And people want to know what they're riding. And they're not going to say, you know, you get very different conversations. You know, there will always be a few people that want a selfie, but most people want to know, what did you ride in on? And what bikes do you, have you got? So I think that idea of it leveling the playing field and being this common ground is amazing. But for those people, when you talk to them, putting the visor down and getting on the road and being anonymous and just being another guy on the road on a bike is part of it. Because, you know, you see it a lot in LA. And you know, there are those people like Brad Pitt and Keanu Reeves out on the road, and they'll turn up at a famous bike stop. And you know, they'll go to Neptune's Net, or they'll you know, they'll go to the old place or rock store, and they're a dude on a bike, and they love that, and you know, they're not quite anonymous, because you know, at the end of the day, they're an A-list celebrity, but a lot of it is just about them being part of the crew.
Is that essence of what biking culture is across the Atlantic, and particularly the West Coast? I haven't had the good fortune of being out on a bike out there a very, very long time ago now, Dutch. I loved it because, first and foremost, you get pretty much nailed on weather, don't you? It's a very temperate climate where you're not packing your waterproofs too many times to make sure that you go through the rain. But that sense, again, of being a biker out there, the huge freeways, there's a lot of lane splitting, cars seemingly very open to bikes getting past and getting on and doing their thing, ripping it up into the canyons and being able to see quite a lot of that part of America. Is that a bit of a contrast, as we said, you kind of putting on your game face to get through London? Is it a bit more relaxing, sun's on your back, a bit more chilled, the riding kind of vibe out there?
It is. I mean, what I would say is LA is one of the most dangerous cities I've ever ridden in, because car drivers are awful.
Right.
They're so dangerous. They're wandering about in the lanes. There are potholes everywhere. The roads are awful. Mm. And they run red lights routinely. They're on their phones doing their makeup, having a chat, watching a film. They're terrible, terrible drivers. And in all my years in Bike Shed, you know, it's very rare that either a member or a customer or a member of staff is hurt on a bike or knocked off. In LA, it's once a month.
Really?
Someone's knocked off their bike. And, you know, and bad things happen because people aren't dressed properly because it's so hot.
Yeah, yeah.
So they're not wearing proper gear. Mm. So, you know, people lose a leg or a foot or something. So it's bad. So on the one hand, it's sort of less relaxed because you really need to keep your wits about you because you're surrounded by morons in cars. Absolute morons, really. I mean, you have to go out and go, there's a target on my back today. And somebody's out to get me. They do love bikes. Mm. And when you lane split, they'll move out of the way and give you a thumbs up. So they love bikes. There's no animosity towards bikers out there, which is nice. But when you get out of LA, oh my God, you know, within 15, 20 minutes, you're on a beautiful road halfway up a mountain in a forest where the tarmac is nice mostly. I mean, it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, one of the best roads in the world is Angeles Crest. Mm-hmm. And it's 20 minutes from Bike Shed at the bottom. And then you've got the coastal roads and PCH and desert roads and Joshua Tree. And you can even, there's a place called Elephant Hill about a mile and a half from Bike Shed where you can take your bike off road. You know, it's just like a big hill in the middle of the northern part of LA. But it's designated off-road land. Mm. And you can take your bike up there. It's like a giant hill on effectively a big plot of land surrounded by houses, and you can rip your dirt bike up there. And you've got all this British land management stuff. There's I can't remember the name of the place, but about sort of, you know, an hour north of London, this is of LA, there's this amazing spot where there's acres and acres of dirt bike, you know, sort of road, and they grade it like skiing. Mm. You've got black runs, green runs, blue runs.
Of course, that.
And you know how difficult it is before you get on it. Well, you know, whether you can take your bike that way. I mean, it's just incredible, the biking there. And, you know, I've done 1,600 miles in 4 days on a biking adventure, and we got basically, we did about a third the length of California.
Mm. Well, if you ever want any tour guides, me and Props will come out and do Bike Shed tours in America, because that sounds idyllic to me. You know, I'm in Hampshire and there's some nice roads around, but it's really interesting you say about the level of skill of the drivers in America compared to London. It must be quite hard when people come to the Bike Shed, they've had a great afternoon, they're totally relaxed, they're chilled out, and then they've got to get on the bike and remember, hang on, I'm in LA, there's idiots everywhere. But yeah, it sounds like you've got, when you go out to LA, it sounds like you've got it on your doorstep out there. Sounds amazing.
The thing that also comes out of this, Ewan, and I'm sure you'll be getting the same envious vibes that I'm getting with it, again, idyllic's the word that it kind of springs to mind, Dutch, because I'd seen as well, we've had Charlie Borman very graciously came on as a guest in series gone by, and he literally, like you see on telly. And I'd seen that you'd been to Tuscany with him on a bike tour, which you're talking about wonderful roads in LA. I mean, riding a bike around Tuscany with that type of company, again, just looks magical.
Tuscany's beautiful. Yeah. I mean, we did the tour with Charlie because we do a lot of adventure stuff at Bike Shed. And we do, right now, Dan's doing the Moroccan 1500, bits of the old Dakar, riding to the top of Cathedral, 600 meter sand dune. I didn't know sand dunes were permanent, but apparently they often are. And this one's the highest one in the world. All these amazing trips, and they're camping in the desert and sometimes a bit of glamping and posh yurts and things. And I was like, Dan, where's the one where you do 200 miles a day and drink wine every night and have a shower? And it's pot. Where's the bougie one? Yeah. You know, I'm getting on. Yeah. You know, I'm not really up for 400 miles a day and sleeping in a tent. You know, I want a posh hotel and a glass of wine. It's a wine tasting. And I was talking to Charlie about that. And I'm like, Charlie, aren't you fed up with all the camping and all this stuff? And he was like, yeah, let's do the bougie tour.
Nice.
And where's the bougiest, poshest place with the nicest food? And we thought, well, Tuscany, right? So let's do a tour in Tuscany. Let's make it posh. A proper, you know, that is posh boys on bikes tour, I have to admit it.
Unapologetically posh boys on bikes.
Unapologetically. Unfortunately, only one girl joined us, but we'd like more posh people on bikes. And it was meant to be nice and a bit bougie. And Charlie thought, yeah, let's do that. Call it the Grand Tour, make it grand. Mm-hmm. And we did kind of multiple Ciano and, you know, we did wine tasting and we ate amazing food and we, you know, from Rome to Siena to, I mean, it's just incredible. You know, the whole thing was just a beautiful, you know, 5 days of fantastic riding. And the roads are incredible. Mm-hmm. Really, you know, you're doing these kind of windy roads lined with cypress trees, and it's absolutely beautiful. And I can't wait to do that again next year. And obviously, Charlie's great company. Mm-hmm. And I like riding with Charlie as well. You know, you find people you can ride with, really, you enjoy the riding. Mm-hmm.
He's a good rider as well. I've been out with him. He's a decent rider.
He's quick and talented. One of those people that can just get on a bike and ride it. And can wheelie anything. He's good on a track day. He's good off road. I mean, considering how bashed up and broken he is, he's a remarkable motorcycle rider. Really, really good, and a lovely guy in good company. No bull. Mm. He's a good guy. I hope he's not watching this, Charlie. I don't think you're that cool.
Keep him on his toes.
But yeah, it was brilliant that trip.
So then that begs the question, then, Dutch, given what that trip is and how often you are between London and LA. What's the rest of the year got in store? Is there any other big trips? I suppose, when does the planning for next year's bike shed come into it? Or is that a constant part of your job?
We finish the show, we do a debrief, we start planning the next one. We're talking to brands now about and exhibitors about participation. People are bugging us saying, when can I exhibit my bike? The contracts are signed again with Tobacco Dock, same weekend. It's that second bank holiday weekend in May. So we're already planning the poster shoot. Tickets will go on sale in mid-November. So all of that stuff's already cooking. We worked out our theme. The theme for next year is made by humans in a world of artificial intelligence and robots. I want to remind people that bikes are about people. So, you know, celebrating the craft and the humanity and the creativity of biking. So that's the theme for the year. So, we're already underway with that. Moroccan 1500 is just wrapping up. We've got, it's the Bike Shed's 10th anniversary. In November. Unfortunately, that's not a public event because we've made a lot of friends over the last 10 years. So that is an event where we're having to invite people, but there'll be a bit of a party. But we're doing a lot of things around that. We've got quite a few. We're doing a lot of mini events at weekends and doing things with brands and pop-ups and test rides. Mm-hmm. And we've got an NFL football team at the moment doing some stuff, and they're doing watch parties today and tomorrow. While the NFL's in town. So we're doing a lot of those sorts of things. And obviously we'll celebrate Halloween. I mean, you know, when you run a full-time destination venue, you've kind of got to think of something happening every weekend and a reason to visit. Obviously we screen all the MotoGPs. The last one of the season is always huge and fully booked. So if you want to attend that and view that at Bike Shed, get in now because we're always fully booked weeks before the final race. And then of course we always have a little Christmas party, and New Year's Eve at Bike Shed is brilliant. All our old staff come back, and they're amazing humans, and, you know, people that have worked for Bike Shed over the years, and all of our friends. And it's a really nice little, you know, no bull, no frills, you know, party with great DJing and good fun. So the usual things. And then as February comes around, we'll be back on bikes doing more adventures. We're also doing a lot of these captain's table events where we kind of have people like Elspeth Beard or Nick Saunders or Charlie Borman. will come and host dinners. We do that with Two Wheels for Life. We do a lot of those, raising money to buy bikes for you know, their African kind of charities and stuff, putting doctors on bikes to reach inaccessible places. So, yeah, I mean, if you check out our calendar and follow our social media, you'll see we're up to a lot.
Just jog my memory about what you said with regards to the charitable side of what the bike shed does, and obviously with regards to the community, because you talk about running a business. Can you just give us a quick touch on the work that you did together as bikers in COVID, and also off the back of that, with that sense of community, there's a certain Jamie Theakston that you all rallied around as well, because it does really reference. I think we talk about the cool stuff. We talk about the bit that we all love that gets you as that kind of young man into getting into biking. But there's a real heartbeat to what the bike shed and the community is about, given COVID and given how you helped Jamie as well.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, one of the things I love most about biking is bikers. Mm. They're just the most amazing people. I mean, we all know as riders, you know, if you slow down on the road or stop for a wee, someone's going to pull over and ask if you're all right. Have you broken down? Yeah. Do you need anything? You know, we look out for each other, but they're community-minded people. And the COVID thing was, it sort of came out of a conversation between me and Vicky. Somebody reached out in COVID and said, yeah, my parents are both unwell and difficult to access. I'm really worried about them, and they're not going to be able to go to the shops and do things. Have you got, you know, you've got a huge network across the UK of people who ride. Do you know anyone near them who could just check in on them and see if they're okay? And we were like, yeah, well, we certainly do. We'll find someone. And I think we put something on Facebook, and a couple of people went, yeah, we're local. We'll go check on them. And then Vicky said to me, there are probably a lot of people out there like that, and we've got this huge community of riders. And Vicky sort of has these chats, you know, where she'll kind of throw, she's always got ideas. Mm. You know, I have few ideas, and I think them through quite carefully. She has millions of ideas but they just come thick and fast, and they're brilliant. And she was just talking about it. And while she was talking, I was on Facebook, and I started a Facebook group, and I called it, we're literally chatting. And I was like, what if I started a little group, and I just made it a Bike Shed Community Response? And I was like, well, let's find out. I've made a little group. Shall I make it, you know, let's make this live. And she was like, yeah, let's see what happens. And suddenly within about 2 days, we had 800 volunteers of people going, yeah, how can we help? And we were like, oh, this is a thing. Mm-hmm. So then we realized that there was a lot of things that people on bikes could do. That's why emergency first responders use bikes, right? So, and couriers, because you can get to places other people can't, and quickly. And we realized we had these amazing proactive riders, who are the kind of people that always put their hand up to volunteer for something, as this volunteer group. And we got a whole bunch of people involved, Team Rubicon. We got a courier app called Gopher, where you can sign yourself up to be a courier to make their app free for our riders. We got police checks on everybody. Mm-hmm. Worked out that we could sign these people up and get them ascribed and prove they had insurance and an MOT and a proper bike. And we ended up with 1,200 volunteers. And we didn't really know how far it would go, because nobody knew how long COVID would run. But over 22 months, we did 30,000 jobs with these 1,200 volunteers. Word. And we started out delivering PPE, because people would say, oh, we're making free PPE in Glasgow, and there's some guys in Birmingham that want it. And we're like, Glasgow to Birmingham, you're like, well, can't you find someone a bit closer? But we had bikers that were quite happy to ride the length of Britain in relays sometimes to pick up the PPE from Glasgow and drop it off in Birmingham. And then we started doing prescriptions for people. And then we got into, you know, sort of getting food. We did stuff with the NED where they kept their kitchens open. We delivered food, mostly where young kids were primary carers for their families. So we were getting food made and delivering that in partnership with the NED. And then the NHS came to us, the Royal Free, and said, we need our surgeons and doctors to be able to come to work. Would you deliver COVID tests on your motorcycles? Bring them back to the hospital. We'll do the test. And then we can ring them up and say, look, you've just got a cold, come to work and do your heart surgery or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was the precursor to COVID tests on motorcycles. So we trialed that first. And then when that worked, the NHS went, brilliant, thanks, we've got it now. We'll turn that into a proper service. So we ended up doing this incredible bit of work over a really long period of time. And it also kept me and Vicky sane, because the business had to close. It kept our community sane. I think we saved a few marriages by getting riders out of the house. We created a lot of lifelong friends. It was an amazing thing to do. We got support. We got support from Indian Motorcycles as well. And it was just a brilliant thing. But what I really loved about it was it painted motorcycles in a really good light. you know, again, in a world of kind of phone snatching, sort of wheelie, Asbo riding lunatics and, you know, Sons of Anarchy wannabes, you know, like the DGR, the community response during COVID just showed bikers at their very, very best. And also, you know, we ended up getting the British Empire Medal for that. When I was really tickled by the idea of the Queen and the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson at the time, sitting down and going, oh, those bikes should community response people. What for Britain? Let's give them an award. I love that idea that they're chatting away about Queen bikers. In
I tell you what, Dutch, I'm sure you are. You must not only be immensely proud of the people who stepped forward and helped, but yourself and Vicky, the work you did there, because as you said, it pushes bikers into the forefront for the right reasons. And, you know, there's good people out there and you are one of them, my friend. But before you go, we have to ask you this. Now, it sounds to me that you've already done this route in your mind or in real life, but we like to ask someone about their fantasy ride. So forget your busy timetable for the moment. If you could go anywhere on any bike, on any road in the world, and with whom, who would you go with? Where would it be? What would be the bike? And if there was a soundtrack, what music would you be listening to?
Wow.
So you've probably done this route in real life, but what's your fantasy ride?
You've layered an awful lot of things in there where I have to think quite carefully, especially about who I'd ride with. I don't want to offend people.
You've got to say Charlie now, haven't you? Charlie's got to
I won't say Vicky. I could be in a lot of trouble.
Oh, yeah, true.
I mean, I think, first of all, I mean, when I rode to Tuscany, I rode to Tuscany on my own. And I don't often ride on my own, but I really enjoyed it, just having a bit of time to myself. So maybe to not offend all the people I should be riding with, like Vicky and Charlie, and a very good friend of mine who I'll put a shout out to, Remy, who's moved to France, who I love riding with. Me and Remy just chime on bikes. But, you know, they're all three of them, any three of them would be great company on a ride. And my friend David in LA as well, just in case he ever listens to this, he's really good company on a bike. But I think what I'd quite like to do is ride into Europe. Long way home with Ewan and Charlie, where they did kind of Northern Europe, was kind of interesting. All the kind of the fjords and kind of, you know, getting into Scandinavia. I like the south. I like where it gets warmer the further you ride rather than colder. I don't like rain. Tuscany was a taster for that whole bit of the world. And people talk about riding in places like Albania and Romania and there's whole bits of the Black Forest in Germany and doing the Alps. And I think southern France, northern Italy, Spain, I think I'd like to do like a sort of 3-4 week tour of southern Europe. Nice. On a motorcycle, because it's food, it's accommodation, it's history, it's medieval towns, it's all of that stuff as well. That I really, really love. I mean, I think Europe is an incredible place that is underrated because we're in it all the time. I think it's fantastic, you know, and it's the seat of modern civilization. So I think that would be my stomping ground. And also I'd like to only have to do 150, 200 miles a day to do the twisties, because riding to Tuscany when you're trying to do 400 miles a day means a lot of motorways and it's boring. So if I was doing that, the Desert X, which was the bike I took, is the perfect bike. But I think I'd probably like to do it on something like the Thruxton.
Nice.
Where I'm just doing twisty roads and I don't have to go, what time am I arriving? I think the real amazing thing would be to not have a destination town, have some options. And you stop at sort of lunchtime or tea time and you get your phone out and you get on your app and you get on Expedia or booking.com, book a hotel, book it then, because you can always do that. And then decide where you've got to get in the next 4 hours, 3 hours, because you've done half your trip. So that for me would be ideal, would being on a bike like that, you know, heading across beautiful places where there's a sort of level of dense population, but it's all different. Yeah. And you're moving through languages and dialects and vibes and cuisines really quickly, even from northern Italy to southern Italy or northern Spain to southern Spain, everything changes. Mm. And I think that would be my dream trip, actually.
Love it. Go in with the flow. And that's the beauty of being a biker. Mm. I think you've summed it up. You don't necessarily have to be going on a specific journey. You just go and you go with it and you love it. And we've loved having you on, Dutch. Yeah. It's been awesome.
I think as well that when you talk about your varied career path, Dutch, there's a hint of the director in there as well. That sounds like a travel log. that would be the perfect one, wouldn't it? We see all these travel logs on various different channels. If you got that commissioned with yourself front and center, I think you would have nailed it.
Well, maybe someone better on camera to come with me. But yeah, something like that would be awesome.
It sounds absolutely, again, idyllic's a word that keeps popping up with this. It's just been a pleasure. And getting really stuck into what the community did in COVID is really quite a, it's just sits and makes you think, doesn't it, Ewan? There was a lot of, yeah. We all went through powerful, a lot of the same stuff. There was a lot of people that retrospectively now were doing things that have been questioned, as without going into details with that for fear of getting into murky kind of legal territory. But to altruistically go out there and say with Vicky, people need help, how do we help? I think is something really, really special. And I think all the success off the back of that and before that and continued is absolutely amazing. But unfortunately, that's about it for this week's episode of Full Chat, powered by Bikeshore. As ever, we love you lots. As the UK's largest independent motorcycle insurance broker, Bikeshore will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help you save money on your annual bike, scooter or moped insurance and so much more, Ewan.
Yeah, they certainly will. Thank you to this week's guest, because genuinely, that has been such a brilliant chat. Loved it. Loved it when I've met you in person. Love what you were doing for the biking community. And he only needs one name, like Beyonce. Thank you very much, Dutch.
Thank you. Brilliant. Loved it. Really good chatting with you guys. A real pleasure.
Like Beyonce. And we must get ourselves down to the bike shed again soon, you. We'll take your big Harley in there, scaring the life out of everyone sat having a flat white. Don't forget to press the subscribe button on YouTube so they never miss an episode, or press the follow button on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcast from.
As ever, thank you very much to everybody who's been listening, and until next time, ride safely.